Continuing our retrospective of Ingo Swann, one of the fathers of remote viewing, and talking to another one, Russell Targ, on the line in California. He has a new book out called The Reality of ESP, a physicist's proof of psychic abilities. And we'll get into that book here in a little bit. Russell, thanks for joining us.
I'm very happy to be with you. If it wasn't for Ingo, there would be no remote viewing program.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about what happened there at Stanford with Ingo and you and everyone else there. Tell our audience a little bit about the background of this.
Well, in the beginning, Ingo worked intermittently with Hal Puthoff, another physicist at SRI, and they were doing experiments. One of the great experiments they did before we had a program, Ingo went to Stanford University with Hal, and he focused his attention on a superconducting experiment that they were going to put in orbit to measure whether the Earth dragged the nature of space-time with it as it rotated. So the frame-dragging experiment. So Ingo was invited to look at the superconducting object in the basement of the physics building and see if he could affect it. And Ingo and Hal were there, and the thing was oscillating like a little clock, up and down electrically. And then Ingo was able to greatly slow it down so that this most precise clock in the universe suddenly started running half as fast as it had been. And everybody was very upset about that. The Navy was upset about it because they were paying for it. And we said, well, that's very good. We'd like to come back again and see if we can do this another day, because doing an experiment one time is not publishable. And they said, thanks very much. We've seen all of you. We want to see. Get the hell out of here. But we have the charts showing what it looked like before Ingo came, as he was standing there, and then what happened when he started to focus his psychic attention on this little superconducting sphere. So that was the first idea that we had a psychic superstar to work with. Then in September, I showed up, and I already had interested NASA. I had a meeting with Von Braun and the director of NASA, Jim Fletcher, Werner Von Braun, and Jim Fletcher, and Arthur C. Clarke, and the astronaut Edgar Mitchell. So I was invited to a fancy conference at the St. Simon Island Retreat Center in May, and I was able to get interest from Von Braun to support our work. I had a ESP teaching machine, which I brought with me, and Von Braun got very, very high scores on that. And he said to Fletcher, who had all the dough, the head of NASA, give the guys some money to do their experiment. So when I showed up in September, it was easy for the president of SRI to say, let's make a program. Hal had the psychic superstar, Ingo. I had some money from NASA, and we promised to keep our mouth shut and not make any trouble.
Yeah, so you said keep your mouth shut. Actually, this was a super secret Stanford investigative unit, right?
I mean, that's right. By the next thing that happened is we had a contract from the CIA. Hal and I did some experiments with Ingo and with the psychic policeman, Pat Price, to show that people could sit quietly in a laboratory and describe what it looked like where somebody was hiding. And both Ingo and Pat could do that very, very well, this kind of remote viewing of a distant person. So Hal and I went to the CIA, and we talked to John McMahon, who is the director of the CIA, and said, I think we have an ability that could be useful for national security. And he said, well, if you can do a demonstration of your ability, then we'll give you some dough. And the agreement we made with the CIA is that we would spend half our time finding hostages and missing generals and downed airplanes and Russian bomb tests. We would do all that stuff for them half our time. And the other half of the time, we wanted to try and understand how ESP works and publish our findings. And John McMahon, the very thoughtful scientist slash lawyer, said, okay, if you can describe my site to my satisfaction, I will go along with your deal. So we made this deal with the devil. The CIA is not our favorite person to work with, but if they'd support all of our work and call on only half of our time. So we did indeed find a downed Russian airplane in North Africa. Ingo Swann, amazingly, was able to describe a Chinese atomic bomb test 3 days before it occurred. The CIA came to us and said, something is going to happen at these coordinates, latitude and longitude. Can you describe what's going to happen there in 3 days? And Ingo said, well, I need my colored pencils for that. This is a very beautiful event. And he drew all over his big drawing pad a pyrotechnic display, like the 4th of July in different colors. And he said, I see this thing like a pyrotechnic display, lots of hemispherical circles up in the sky, and off in the background there's a big row of trucks. And we showed that to the CIA guy who was watching. And what that meant to that, they knew that a Chinese atomic bomb test was scheduled 3 days in the future. So we were doing this Monday morning. They knew that on Thursday, the Chinese were scheduling an atomic bomb test. And they wanted to know, could our new psychic describe something in the future? And it turned out, from looking at this, the CIA was able to say, if Ingo is correct, the CIA could tell that, yes, they would do their atomic bomb test and it would fail, because what Ingo drew was a picture of an atomic bomb test in which you had uranium burning in the atmosphere but no mushroom cloud. So this is the kind of pyrotechnic display you get when you have a failed atomic bomb test. And indeed, 3 days later, the Chinese did do their atomic bomb test, and it did fail.
And now, who came up with the term remote viewing?
Ingo invented remote viewing.
He did.
Hal and I and Ingo were sitting in my office in the beginning of the program and said, how should we describe this? Should we call it psychic ability? And Hal said, no, I don't want to call it. This is Stanford Research Institute. We don't want to call this psychic anything. So I said, well, it's sort of like remote sensing, don't you think? And Ingo said, no, it's more like remote viewing. I close my eyes and describe the images that appear in my awareness. I'm an artist, and what I'm doing is viewing the future. So that's when remote viewing got born, to the best of my ability. So that'd be like September, October of 1972. Seems like yesterday.
I bet it does. Now, we're talking with Russell Targ. We talked about his work at Stanford, but he did graduate work in physics at Columbia University, right?
That's right.
And you've written nine books now, I think, maybe.
Nine books, most of them about psychic abilities.
Yeah, and we're going to talk in a little later in the show about psychic ability and natural healing and things like that. Your interests keep evolving.
Yeah, well, nothing like getting sick to become interested in healing.
I understand.
So I got sick in 1992, and my friend Jane Catra, who was a healer, went to the hospital with me, and they took x-rays and ultrasound and had very dire-looking spots on the film from x-raying me. They said, well, we better do chemotherapy because it looks like you have a recurrence of cancer. And Jane said, I don't think we should do chemotherapy. He's not even sick. All you've got is some spots on film. That doesn't mean he's sick. So she took me home, took good care of me, and 5 weeks later, I was all better. So
interesting.
We We don't know that she cured my cancer, but she definitely saved me from chemotherapy. And we're now 25 years past that, and I'm still here making trouble.
Now you worked at one time at Lockheed Martin, didn't you, at the Missile and Space Company?
Yeah, my last straight job was putting lasers on airplanes to measure wind shear and prevent airplanes from crashing from air turbulence. So I started out as a laser guy before there were any lasers. So when I left graduate school, I was sort of seduced out of graduate school to work on the coolest project in the world, which is to build the first laser. I had two good friends. One of them was the inventor of the laser, Gordon Gould, said, you're going to be in graduate school forever. Gould, in fact, left Columbia. He was the smartest guy around and really had the initial idea for the laser. And I worked with him for 3 years. We did not build the first laser, but we built one pretty soon after the first laser. And then I came to California. So
there in Palo Alto, you're no longer involved in lasers, but ESP research. How do you go from lasers to ESP?
Well, I began as a stand-up magician.
All right.
I lived in New York City. I lived in New York City. So a 11 or 12-year-old had the run of the city, so I could go to the magic shows and Hubert's Freak Circus, the Flea Circus, and see people doing magic, stand-up magic. And I was a little kid. I could stand right in front of the guy and talk to the magician. And then I could go into the office buildings to the professional magic stores like D. Robbins and Tannen's and Holden's, where the professional magicians bought their stuff. And I began to do stage magic. And my experience as a kid doing magic and pretending to read people's minds, my experience is that I would occasionally have visual images pertaining to the person I was pretending to do mind reading for. Of course, the mind reading is a trick, but I could supplement my trick with whatever images came to me. And as a young scientist, I became more interested in figuring out how the ESP work than in perfecting my trickery. So I began to read the literature, and I met J.B. Rhine and became friends with the other mental magicians and people like Kreskin today. I was on the air last year with the great Kreskin, and he said, oh, yes, magicians always have or often have psychic impressions of the person they're reading. And if they're experienced and careful, they can add in the ESP that comes their way to the trick they're doing.
So when you can actually tell what other people are thinking, huh?
Yes, or visualizing.
So what do you mean by visualizing it? Explain that for a minute.
If I'm standing on the stage, and I've already secretly read the card you've written out. You're looking for your dog. And so that my trick is I close my eyes and I hold the card up to my forehead, and I see Jerry has written on this card that I'm holding to my forehead, pretending to psychically read, you're looking for your dog. And I, of course, have no idea where your dog is. But I might have a flash of what your house looks like. I could say that you have a house, single-family house in the country, and a tree in the front yard, and as you walk in the house, you go up the stairs, and in the bedroom, there's a patchwork quilt on the bed. So that's just my image. I will have to have a pretty damn clear picture of that in my mind to say that on the stage. But most of the time, I would open my mouth and say that it would be correct. So I began to have ideas of how you separate the psychic signal from the mental noise. So I would fold in my ESP images to enhance the trickery I was doing. But I was aware that you can't make a living doing parapsychology. So when I left Columbia, I was doing laser work for the next 15 years. And that worked very well because I came to California and was one of the very few scientists on the West Coast who knew anything about a laser, how to build it, how it worked. So I got invited to set up a laser lab for General Telephone in Palo Alto. And I did that for a decade. But in the back of my mind was little ESP drum, ESP idea continuing. So I built this ESP teaching machine. And if you want to know about that, eventually NASA supported experiments with the ESP teaching machine. But I have now put that on the iPhone as a free application. So I have a very nice-looking game called ESP Trainer, which is a free app for the iPhone.
And many
thousands of people are using that and are improving their psychic abilities.
So when you met Ingo Swann, you already had something in common with him.
You knew a little bit about ESP? We had two things in common. We were passionate about ESP, and I thought that I had a little bit going for me, and he understood how it worked. Not only was he a prodigious psychic, but he was the first person who talked about separating the psychic signal from the mental noise. Very important idea. Because he said that J.D. Ryan's work at Duke University had Ryan asking people to guess ESP cards, circles, square, stars, wavy line, so that the student trying to guess the card always knew what the potential card was. So he had the mental noise of his memory of guessing the cards. So if your listeners want to develop their psychic abilities, do not start out guessing playing cards. That's very, very difficult to do, because the image you already have of all of the cards interferes with your ability. So the things that make it hard to do remote viewing is what Inga called analytical overlay, AOL. And it's memory and analysis and imagination and naming and guessing. So at the Ryan experiments at Duke University, people would be guessing cross, circle, square, because they knew what the possibilities were. And many of the students did excellently, highly significantly, and Ryan published this work. But unfortunately, they always got worse. There's a big decline effect. And one of the problems in Ryan's work at Duke is the students always declined. The very good news in remote viewing of natural targets, which is outside places and objects, you never know what the thing is going to be. Consequently, in two decades of work at Stanford, we never saw a decline. Very important idea. Our people get better over time rather than getting worse. And the difference is, if I ask you, Jerry, if I ask you to tell me the number I'm thinking of from 1 to 10, you might say, well, Russell wouldn't guess 1 or 10 because he just named those, and he probably wouldn't guess 7 because that's everybody's lucky number. That process is pure analysis, has nothing to do with ESP, and will interfere with your ability to be psychic. Hard to do. On the other hand, if I tell you, I can visualize a place somewhere in the world, very interesting place, for certain reasons, I think it's most unlikely that you've ever seen this place. But I can visualize it very well. And if I was sitting quietly with you and asking you to make a drawing of my place, it's very likely you could make an excellent drawing of my place, even though it's one place out of an infinitude of possible places. So it's easier to get one mystery place out of an infinity of places than it is to guess something from 1 to 10. And that's the important thing that Ingo taught us, that the idea of analytical overlay screws up your ability to see your psychic pictures, because in your mental screen, you always have a picture of the limited set of possibilities.
You were at Stanford Research Institute in the 70s and 80s.
That's right.
Worked for NASA, CIA, all we could go on the list.
Defense Intelligence Agency.
Was Ingo there all that time, too?
Ingo was there for all of the first decade and for part of the subsequent decade. I left at the end of a decade. Hal and I formed the program in 1972. I left in 82, and he left in 84. What happened, Hal and I are really scientists. So we're both laser guys interested in modern physics. We sort of didn't grow up to be psychic spies for the CIA. That was not my career objective. I was passionate about understanding ESP, but by the 1980s, the CIA would no longer let us, actually, it was Army Intelligence, would no longer let us publish anything. The CIA behaved very honorably. They paid us well. They let us do what we wanted to do. They allowed us to write books and publish papers in Nature magazine and the Proceedings of the Engineering Society. So the CIA was completely open with our talking about laboratory experiments. Of course, we couldn't talk about finding General Dozier kidnapped by the Red Brigade or locating a downed Russian bomber in Africa, Chinese atomic bomb test. We couldn't talk about that. But we could talk about Pat Price's ability to describe day after day where Hal had been taken in the Bay Area. Or we could talk about Ingo's ability to quiet his mind and for NASA describe for the first time rings around Jupiter. No one had ever seen rings around Jupiter before. It was an unknown item. NASA was supporting our ESP teaching machine, and a contract monitor said, well, we're going to send off the Pioneer spacecraft to Jupiter in a few days. Can you tell us anything that we'll find that we don't know about? CIA and NASA, people always say, tell me something I don't know about. That way they can't give us the answer by mental telepathy. The bad news, it then takes a very long time to get feedback. So Ingo went into a quiet room with Hal and said, my gosh, as I'm closing in on Jupiter, I'm just 10,000 miles away from Jupiter, said Ingo. I can see there's a ring of ice crystals all the way around the planet. It's like the ring around Saturn, but much more diaphanous. But I can see the crystal shining in the sunlight. I know you can't see them from Earth, but when the spacecraft gets there, I'm sure the spacecraft will see it. And a couple of years later, we had the code printed out, and NASA said, yes, indeed, just like Swan said, there is indeed a ring around Jupiter. And in my book, In the Reality of ESP, I published for the first time Ingo's transcript together with his drawing and the NASA photograph of the ring around Jupiter millions of miles away. So Ingo always felt that describing the object in the box or the picture in the envelope was what he called a trivialization of his ability. He said, if I can focus my attention anywhere on the planet, why would I want to look in your stupid envelope? If I want to see what's in the envelope, I'll open it. If I want to see what's in the next room, I'll walk in. That's not a psychic task for me. I can look anywhere in the world.
How did Ingo feel about life on other worlds and things like that? I mean, didn't he write something in a book in 1998 about life on the moon or something?
He wrote a book called Penetrations, where he felt that there was a whole colony on the moon.
And during your decade there at Stanford with him, did he ever discuss things like that?
Well, he and Pat Price were both quite convinced that there were UFOs and that they were in our neighborhood and took part in our lives one way or the other. I was interested in what they were telling me, but I still had my physics hat on, and I know that there's no way in principle to verify what they're telling me. If Ingo tells me there's a UFO base under Mount Shasta, that's very interesting, but that sort of doesn't advance our understanding of ESP, because nobody's going to go dig up Mount Shasta. So I may be disappointing for some of your listeners in that Hal and I, although we're interested in ESP, we spent a lot of time talking to Jacques Vallée, who's a world expert on that subject. We did not actually spend very much time pursuing the UFO side of this thing.
Now, as far as the government's concerned, you alluded to that a little earlier, who you all worked for. I mean, did you guys actually have some surprises for the government, or did they usually know what you were talking about when you went to them?
We always surprised them. As one of the things that happened is General Dozier was kidnapped from Venice in Italy. The U.S. Army four-star was kidnapped by the Red Brigade, and nobody had any idea where he was. And Joe McMonagall, who's one of the people that we trained, slight digression, we trained six Army intelligence officers in remote viewing. That I sat in the dark with them day after day for a week and taught them how to quiet their mind and describe what was happening in the distance, and then encouraged them to draw the images that appeared in their awareness. And after a week of doing that, all six of the people, or at least five of the six people, did quite well. And one of those was Joe McMonagall, who's probably the greatest living, with the departure of Ingo, Joe is probably the greatest living psychic. And he was one of those that we trained. So what happened is that Ingo showed Hal and me how to do remote viewing. Then we had a program from Army Intelligence to train the Army, and we trained six people that we chose from Army Intelligence to set up a Army Psychic Corps at Fort Meade, Maryland. And they did that. We had support from their commanding general to do that. And they then taught quite a number of other people, and as the whole program folded up in 1995, all these guys retired and created something called the International Remote Viewing Association. So they have now trained many hundreds and hundreds of people. Most of the people that we trained in the Psychic Army Corps are now professional remote viewing trainers. So what happened is that Ingo trained Hal and me, we trained the Army, and the Army trained the world. So that even if one of your listeners doesn't believe in ESP, that person can go to Google and search for remote viewing with quotation marks, and there's 2.5 million pages on Google pertaining to remote viewing, how it works, and how to find a teacher. So that's a huge repository of previously classified and unclassified info that people can inform themselves.
Do you still teach remote viewing?
I'm trying to retire, but I've gotten good reviews, and people keep asking me to do it. So it's not hard to learn remote viewing, but it's hard to teach it, because you have a responsibility to sort of provide enough energy to get the person to quickly do something that he previously thought impossible. So if somebody invites me to give a talk about remote viewing, I'm always happy to do that. But just today I got an invitation to go to Sardinia off the coast of Italy. Would I like to do a week-long workshop teaching remote viewing in the summertime? Well, that sounds like a pretty cool thing to do. It's lots of fun. I'll probably go. But I've been telling people that I've retired from teaching remote viewing. So the answer is, I'm not really teaching remote viewing unless you make me a sensation, unless you make me an offer I can't refuse.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your book again. Give the name again for our people.
The Reality of ESP, A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Abilities.
Now, in your book, you deal with psychic ability, and you also get into spiritual healing, which we kind of touched on a little bit on why you did that. Tell me a little bit more about that. I'm in a situation where I'm very similar.
What
happened to you in the 90s? And tell me how the spiritual healing works.
I call it a physicist's proof of psychic ability. It's very hard to prove anything. But now after 40 years since we began remote viewing, as amazing as that seems. So after 40 years, the scientific and statistical evidence for remote viewing is enormously convincing. For example, one of the things I talk about in my book is the evidence for ESP is 10 times greater statistically than the evidence that an aspirin prevents a heart attack. So the National Institutes in Health stopped the aspirin experiments because they felt it was unfair to hold out the aspirin from the control group because it was the evidence was so strong that aspirin prevents heart attacks. And, of course, everybody is now taking an aspirin. But the evidence for ESP is 10 times greater than that. So what I'm saying is it's now statistically unreasonable to deny the existence of psychic ability. It's statistically proven to the extent that anything in science can ever be proven. So you wanted to ask something about the healing side now.
Yeah, I want to know about the healing. I mean, should I put all my eggs in the basket that spiritual healing can work, or?
I mean, the evidence for spiritual healing is very good. My daughter, Elizabeth Targ, was a psychiatrist in San Francisco, and Elizabeth had more permission to be psychic than anybody. As a child, she grew up, and we expected her to be intelligent, polite, and psychic, the three things we expected from our little girl. And she became a psychiatrist, Stanford-trained, and one of her first formal experiments as a clinician was to see if experienced spiritual healers around the country could help her AIDS patients. And that was San Francisco in the 90s, so she had lots of AIDS patients in her service. And she had created 30 controls and 30 people who were going to receive spiritual healing. And the people who were doing the healing were very experienced. All of her 20 healers had more than 10 years experience as a healer. And in her group, there was a huge difference in the outcome between the prayed-for people and the controls. Her 30 prayed-for men had fewer opportunistic illnesses, fewer trips to the hospital, fewer days in the hospital, better psychological response, and better all-around health. So even though during the experiment it was double blind, she had no idea which people were in the prayed for group subjects didn't know whether they were being prayed for. So the double blind experiment, neither the researcher nor the subjects knew if they were prayed for, but it was a very significant experiment, and she published that in the Western Medical Journal, and the NIH has now spent millions of dollars trying to replicate her experiments. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't, depending on how you do it.
I do a talk show.
For example, if you have a medical problem, I would say, yes, find a healer to send you healing energy and find somebody who is really experienced at doing that. Because some of the NIH has been sort of captured by fundamentalist researchers who said, yes, we want to investigate psychic healing, and I'm going to have the congregation of my church do the healing. And I tried very, very hard to have them not do that, but rather have them do healing with people who actually knew how to do it. And what happened is there was a big million-dollar study where this fellow at Duke University had his congregation pray for some sick people, and they didn't get better. And the reason for that is, if you want people to get better, you should have experienced healers sending them energy rather than your haphazard congregation who doesn't know anything about healing and has no idea how to quiet their mind.
Okay, as you know, I do a talk show and ratings are important, so I got to ask you this. After talking very scientifically, and you're a scientific person, I got to know about remote viewing and sexual experiences. It seems to me that...
I knew you were going to say that. You want to know about sex on the astral plane.
Yeah, I want to know.
Well, Aleister Crowley wrote about that a lot in his autobiography. And they continue them from remote viewing to out-of-body experiences. And in our lab, we never invited anybody to separate their consciousness from their body because we didn't want to have an experience where some subject, some Stanford student, will go to our management and say, Tarek separated my consciousness from my body and I can't get into it. I'm disintegrated ever since he did that. That would be the end of the program. But in working with experienced people, like Ingo or Hella Hammond, who is one of our experienced people, they could learn to bring with them emotionality or sensitivity or sexuality, if that was appropriate, to the distant place. So you can indeed have an interaction emotionally, sexually, or in a healing way with a distant person. And this is best done with consenting adults. But this can be done. The big literature on it. Ingo wrote a book called Psychic Sexuality. I've had this experience. In fact, everything I'm describing here, I've done. So I'm teaching only things that I've experienced because that's how I can teach it. But sex on the astral plane is not for sissies, because you might, once you surrender your protection and go out into the wild psychic world, you might indeed frighten yourself. So if you read Ingo's Psychic Sexuality or Aleister Crowley's writing about astral sex, you'll probably be convinced that it exists. But it's not for the timid.
We're going to have to leave it there, Russell. The name of the book again is?
The name of the book is The Reality of ESP, A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Abilities, and we even have a chapter showing you how to do it.
Now do you have any final words or thought or retrospect about Ingo?
Well, Ingo taught us how to quiet our mind and separate the psychic signal from the mental noise. The most important thing that Ingo taught us is to give up your desire for naming and grasping and guessing. You want to describe the images that show up in his awareness. And Ingo was really the creator of remote viewing as we know it now. There would not have been a... Army, there would not be a remote viewing activity in America if Ingo hadn't started it.
Some people say Ingo Swann is going to report back from what's happening on the other side.
I wouldn't be surprised. The evidence that we can talk about that on another show. The evidence of survival is quite convincing.
We'll have to talk about that again, Russell, soon. Thanks very much for being on.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Russell Targ, quite a man. From magician to laser expert to scientific genius.